As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I'm Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. And we just watched one of the longest 0-0 games that I can remember seeing.
Yeah, I thought it would never end at some point. In fact, I was begging for it to end at some point so I could more consciously switch over to the Canada-Sweden World Juniors game last night. And for some reason, it just wouldn't end. It had to keep going and going and going.
Yeah, the Red Wings end up going to a 0-0 shootout with Columbus. Both goalies made like 30-plus saves, although there was some questioning of how legitimate the shot totals were, possibly inflated shot totals on both ends. But nevertheless, no pucks crossed the goal line until the shootout. Actually, one puck crossed the goal line until the shootout. That was Oliver Bjorkstrand. And it gets called back due to offside. So, very uneventful game. Red Wings pick up a loser point, but Columbus winning it does help those of you who are monitoring the draft standings at this time of year. And, you know, ultimately, I thought the story of the game was the play of Joe Valeno, who makes his debut. And really, I thought looked like he belonged.
Yeah, I mean, Valeno, I think Blashill said it best maybe in his press conference that it very clearly looked like he was a guy who played two professional years in the year prior, obviously having his AHL year and then his SHL year. But, I mean, he looked poised. He was not afraid to throw the puck on the net except for that, you know, one sequence on the power play where he probably should have taken that shot, but, you know, deferred there. But, I mean, besides that, thought he was, you know, good on the puck defensively. I thought he was positionally sound. And he found himself with a little bit more ice time than I think a lot of people expected him to get after he'd only played, I think, a little over 2 minutes in the first period.
Yeah, I mean, the first period was when the Red Wings were on the penalty kill the most. I think it was at least two or three penalties they had to kill in the first period. And so, yeah, you saw him right under 3 minutes, I think, is what it was in the first. And that, I thought, was probably why. Now, someday, could Joe Valeno kill penalties? Probably in his first NHL game, probably not. So I think that explained the first period ice time. But as the game went along, it seemed like he was being trusted upon to keep going out there, keep taking his shift in a 0-0 game. And I thought he justified it. I mean, he had the one steal really early in the game. He picks a defender or was it a defenseman's pocket? It was in the Columbus zone.
Yeah.
Picks his pocket, you know, 30 feet from the Columbus goalie and creates a really dangerous, maybe even less than that from the Columbus goalie, creates a really dangerous look for himself. Later in the game, he had a nice shot on goal. So I thought Joe Valeno, really from the full perspective here, he had good back checks, obviously. That's always going to be important for young players in the Red Wings system coming up. I thought he acquitted himself really well. And if he keeps playing like this, you know, I think that will go a long way toward getting him a spot on the opening night next year.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably at this point, it's exactly like you said, that if over the next five games he plays with that same kind of poise, positioning that Jeff Blashill seems to look for, I think you've probably seen him play his last game for Grand Rapids. I think he, you know, can become a fixture in the lineup. I think the other thing to sort of note is he also, you know, did quite well. He handled himself in the faceoff dot, which is sometimes a challenge for some of these younger players to come in and be able to win faceoffs at the NHL level on a consistent basis. I think initially he was credited at, 4-0 in the first period, and then I think they ended up taking one away. But for the game, he ends up finishing +1 in faceoff wins, which is, again, coming out better than 50% in your first professional game at the NHL level, I think is a huge, huge win for him. And so ultimately, I think you have to be encouraged by what you saw there, just all facets of Valeno's game.
You mentioned not playing another game in Grand Rapids. I mean, is the argument that he wouldn't finish this season in GR, even though it goes longer, just because he's played a full season already? Or do you just mean kind of like broadly, he's never going to be playing GR over Detroit again if he keeps playing like this?
Yeah. More the latter one. I mean, okay, I don't see why they wouldn't send him down to finish the season after the Wings finish this year. But broadly speaking, like, you know, this may be the last, if he plays this way, he's not going to play in Grand Rapids over Detroit if Detroit's an option for him.
Yeah, okay. I agree with that. I mean, I think, if, you know, the way that he was last night, I think is kind of the ideal debut for a rookie. And I did everything except kind of score, which you know, he got the shots that could have scored and will eventually lead to him creating offense either for him or for his line mates. Even off that turnover, you know, that rebound pops a little different, and maybe you're looking at a Sam Gagner tap-in goal. So I was really impressed with Valeno, and certainly if he keeps that up, it will mean good things for him and even better things for the Red Wings.
Yeah, I mean, because, again, we've talked about the importance of having some of these guys hit in ways where they outperform where they were drafted, you know, Valeno being 30th overall. Obviously, there are some expectations already tagged to him there, but if he can come in and be that really solid middle six center that you're sort of hoping for on the upside of things, then I think that really, again, accelerates what Detroit's able to do and sort of gives them another chip to work with, gives Yzerman another card to play with, and ultimately kind of pushes the Red Wings a little bit further in their rebuild process.
Last year, to open the season, the Red Wings had their six most recent first-round picks starting in Grand Rapids, that being Evgeny Svechnikov, Michael Rasmussen, Dennis Cholowski, Philip Zadina, Joe Valeno, and Moritz Seider. Five of those six now currently in Detroit, and another one in Seider, who, by all, you know, all we can tell, would also be, if that were possible for him to be.
Yeah, I mean, if you didn't have, obviously, the whole SHL COVID playoffs shutdown, and he doesn't go to the SHL, then Mo Seider is in the NHL already by now. So it's kind of nice to see that progression of those guys really quickly. I think that's something that, you know, maybe fans had lamented in years past, where there was this very slow, intentional, methodical progression of these guys. You had six of them in Grand Rapids last year, and five of the six are in the NHL this year, and really would be six of six if Seider could do that. But, you know, ultimately speaking, I think that's a nice progression from each of those guys.
How many of them are in Detroit on opening night next year?
That's a great question. The two that are most up in the air for me are Svechnikov and Cholowski, surprisingly. The two older draft picks of the crop, I think, are the two that are maybe least likely to be there. I think pending how the expansion draft goes with Seattle, one of those two could be unprotected and selected by Seattle. Both are restricted free agents this offseason. I imagine that Detroit doesn't walk away from either of them, that and they will qualify both of them. But, you know, we'll certainly see. And I think from a roster spot perspective, if Valeno plays the way he's playing now, I think he's earned himself a spot. Zadina is very clearly going to be there. Rasmussen's been a fixture for a majority of the season. It's hard to envision a scenario where those three are not. And with Mo Seider coming over, obviously Cholowski's lefty, Seider's righty, so I don't think it necessarily impacts that in that perspective. But I have a hard time seeing maybe those two guys as being slam dunks to be on the opening night roster.
I agree those would be the two questions. I'm a little more confident in Cholowski than I am in Svechnikov at this point. I actually think Cholowski's played pretty well, you know, in this call-up. I know some people have talked about kind of the hesitancy, or maybe you're not seeing him look to make kind of quite the same amount of plays, but he's obviously he had a beautiful goal the other night, nearly had one that was almost identical to it a couple of games prior, or maybe the game prior. And I think he's been really steady playing with Filip Hronek. Like that duo seems to work really well. I don't know if it's the mobility or the puck moving or what it is, but I think they complement each other really well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a huge gift for Chulowski, is the last couple of games being able to play with Filip Hronek, who's a little bit more of a steadying presence. And maybe you're asking Chulowski to do less of the work in that sense, because you do have a guy who's a good puck mover in Filip Hronek, and he is a good bailout option for Chulowski to be able to throw the puck back to, and very good positionally in his own zone. So I think all of that really helps Chulowski, as opposed to him sort of scrambling around and having to chase the play a little bit more. And you saw that, I think, in the game against Columbus. That pair was one of Detroit's better pairs, and they did a nice job overall in a pretty hefty amount of ice time. I think Chulowski finished with almost 19 minutes at even strength, which is a huge amount of ice time for him, and really ice time he wasn't getting in years prior and even games prior. So I think hopefully that serves as a big confidence boost for him, and he continues to kind of figure out his decision-making, shows a little bit less hesitancy. I still think you see the moments.
Yeah.
I think one of the first rushes of the game, he turns the puck over at center ice on a pretty sloppy pass where basically all of his outlets are taken away, and he just chips it over to the area near the bench, and there's absolutely no one there to pick that puck up, and ends up being a rush in the other direction. So that stuff still needs to get ironed out, but I think Blashill giving him minutes, putting him with Filip Hronek, is definitely a big confidence boost for a guy like him.
They did get crushed in shot attempts, but they won the expected goals battle, and that seems to be a trade-off the Red Wings are pretty consistently willing to make. Is they're going to prioritize the quality, which is really all they can do. I don't know that they're built to dominate shot share, but in terms of doing their job, winning their shifts, I think that the best measure for that, at least how the Red Wings have operated, probably is expected goals, and they graded out well as a pair in that department.
Yeah, and really that's sort of been a theme for the Wings across the season, where they're very much okay allowing teams to tee off from the perimeter so long as they're not giving up high quality scoring chances, and that sort of bears out in the numbers against Columbus there. Columbus had a lot of perimeter chances. I thought if you go back and you look at the game, even though the shot attempt certainly seemed inflated to me, the team that had the better quality chances was by far Detroit. And so that just seems to be a common refrain for the Wings.
Yeah. The one I have a hard time with is Svechnikov, because I look at next year and I don't see a spot for him. I mean, I'm having a hard time finding. I know there's some guys who are going to be free agents, but some of those guys are guys that I think it makes a lot of sense to bring back. And, Sam Gagner being one of them. I don't know how, if you're going to pay about the same price for the two of them, and right now they are about the same price, I don't know how you pick Svechnikov over Gagner, realistically. I mean, I guess the argument is he's younger, but if you just took out, if you strip it of the context of he was a first-round pick 6 years ago and his last name is Svechnikov, how do you pick him over Sam Gagner if you're the Red Wings?
I mean, I don't know. I took a lot of heat for saying I wouldn't protect Evgeny Svechnikov when I wrote, who I would protect for the expansion draft. But, truth be told, a lot of people still view him as a prospect. The guy's going to be 25 by the time next season starts.
But who's a lot of 20... people? Like fans, or are you talking like
NHL? Oh, I'm talking about fans.
Oh, yeah.
No, fans. Yeah. I took a lot of heat from fans, for saying I wouldn't protect Evgeny Svechnikov. But, I mean, there's a couple of things where we're at right now. Yes, he's had bad injury history, and yes, he has a pedigree of being a pretty solid offensive hockey player, but in the games that they've been able to get him in at the NHL level, he doesn't consistently drive play. He doesn't consistently, move the needle for me and really for the Red Wings as a whole. He's going to be 25 years old in October as you're getting ready to start this 2021-2022 season. And he's starting to get passed by all the forwards that have been picked after him. I mean, we're already talking about Lucas Raymond. We're talking about Jonathan Bergeron as being outside chances to make this roster. I don't know how you have Svechnikov in a spot over those guys. And I understand that there's this perception that he didn't get a fair shake, and that may be true. His injury history certainly limited how quickly the Wings were able to get him up, and then limited his ability to stick in the lineup. But at the end of the day, you got to evaluate him on what he's done and what he's likely to do moving forward. I don't see enough here to where I think Svechnikov is going to be successful in Detroit.
Go ahead.
I was going to say maybe he's successful in another organization that can offer him, you know, a different system, different opportunities, something else. But I just don't see it here in Detroit.
The best thing he has going for him is an expected goals for percentage that is about even. I mean, that's the best thing he plays is because he does have some production. Even though, again, I don't know how much of it he's kind of self-creating. He does seem to play his shifts to a draw, or at least his lines do. And that's probably the best asset that he has going for him. But, you know, I start breaking it down. And this all depends on what the Red Wings do. If they're going to trade one or more forwards or something, or they're not going to re-sign anybody who walks, then sure, you lose nothing by keeping this, you know, former first-round pick around and hoping at some point it happens for him. But let's say they don't. Let's say they keep everybody. Not the unrestricteds, but at least one or two of them, right? You're going to go Larkin, Mantha, Fabry.
No Mantha.
Larkin, Bertuzzi, Fabry. You're going to go Verana, Zadina, Rasmussen, Veleno, Namesnikov. And then you have a spot who I would say which could go to either Bobby Ryan or Sam Gagne. And then you're going to have the fourth line. I don't know if you're re-signing Luke Glendening, but you're going to have Adam Ernie. So you've got two fourth line spots. Is Svechnikov, if you're not re-signing Luke Glendening, then whoever is in that spot is going to be leaned on as your number one penalty killer. That will not be Evgeny Svechnikov. So you've really got a third line wing and a fourth line wing spot kind of up for grabs. One of them I really think probably should go to either Bobby Ryan or Sam Gagne. And one of them I think Evgeny Svechnikov is probably battling any of Lucas Raymond, Giovanni Smith, Jonathan Berggren, and oh, by the way, Richard Panik is still signed, so he probably has to be in that conversation. And I actually think he would, you know, probably be in that lineup based on the way he's played fine since coming over here. He's played like a legit bottom six player. So those are the spots you're battling for. I mean, if you want to argue don't re-sign either of Ryan or Gagne, that's fine. I think I would, but that's fine if other people think not. But, you know, then you can't have Svechnikov and Raymond. That's kind of a non, that's not, there's no way to make the math work on that unless you're going to trade somebody higher up in the lineup, which very well could happen. But I'm just looking at the numbers and I don't see how you fit Svechnikov into the picture here, at least in the lineup. I guess if you want to keep him around and be an extra skater, that's another thing. But Franz Nielsen's already taken up one of those spots unless you buy him out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, based on kind of how you and I prognosticated what the lineup might look like next year, based on what we think Steve Yzerman will do, it's unlikely that multiple guys ahead of Svechnikov are getting moved out. And as a result, you know, he's competing with Gagne there in the bottom six. He's competing with potentially Bobby Ryan getting slotted down there on that third line. And at that point, those are two veteran players that right now contribute more than Evgeny Svechnikov does. And even though Svechnikov, you know, has his age going for him as an asset there, the big issue you run into is, does he have enough in the tank that makes it worthwhile to keep him around? Do you think he has another gear? What do you think his development curve looks like? And at 24 years old, going to be 25 in just a few months, I just personally don't see it happening here in Detroit. That's not to say he can't be successful elsewhere. We've seen Thomas Nosek, who was the expansion draft selection by Vegas, has continued to be successful for Vegas in their bottom six. He's still a piece for them over there. Even Thomas Yurko got into games for Vegas after he bumped around. So, you know, maybe the environment in Detroit isn't set up for him to be there, and maybe he's going to be successful elsewhere, but I just don't see it happening here in Detroit to make me want to keep him around.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the other side of what you mentioned with maybe him not necessarily getting a fair shake. I think that is a fair point. Like, I think you could have him in more prominent roles, although he has played on the first line like fairly often over the last month. But if that is your contention, you also have to grant that it means the Red Wings aren't, for whatever reason, giving him those opportunities. Why would that change? I mean, that they've waived him twice. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that, I think that tells me all I need to know about where this is headed. I could be wrong. I'm not saying they 100% will not bring him back. I'm just saying I have a hard time seeing them, you know, reserving a space in the lineup, I guess would be the way I would put it.
Yeah, and I have to agree with that. I just don't see how you can carve out a set space for him at this point in time.
Yeah.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, moving on from there, I think you had one eye on last night's game, one eye on the first period at least of Canada-Sweden at the World U18s. I was able to get to Canada-Sweden after the press conferences, which gave me most of the last two periods. So I don't know, were you able to watch the full game or did you check out midway through?
I think I checked out around, what was it, 7 or 8-0 Canada. I think at that point
I missed four goals.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually missed five because I guess Sweden
did score. Yes, that's true.
But it was really impressive to watch. Canada was absolutely steamrolling. I think it was about 10 minutes into the game and Canada was already up 4-0. I don't even know if the Swedish goaltender at the time, Carl Lindbom, had even made a save. It was completely... just line after line after line coming after Sweden. I don't know if they knew what hit them.
So we're going to talk about some of the standouts from what you saw. You were able to watch, I think, a little more so far overall of this tournament than I've been able to. I got in on some of the USA game on night one, and then, you know, like I said, the second half of Canada-Sweden on night two. I will say, having watched differing halves of the Canada-Sweden game, I think you and I both came away with the same number one standout player, and that is Brant Clark for Team Canada.
Yeah, I mean, Brant Clark, 2 goals, 2 assists in that game against Sweden there. He was all over the ice. I mean, in the first period, had a nice breakout pass to set up one of Shane Wright's first goals, then later joined the rush, was able to score on a nice shot joining the rush. Granted, an NHL goalie would have saved that shot. That was a pretty weak wrist shot that he got off there, but I think as you watched Brant Clark on the ice, I mean, he has excellent poise, makes great decisions, great breakout passes. You know, the big question mark around him is, does he have NHL-level skating? Truth be told, I was watching him dictate pace of play just from his blue line last night, and he kind of solidified his position for me as, in my opinion, the clear-cut number two defenseman in the draft. And if not, giving Owen Power some question marks there. Now, Power obviously doesn't get the advantage of being able to participate in this tournament. So you don't necessarily get to see him in action here. But, I mean, Brant Clark looked just absolutely dynamite.
I thought he looked good. And I will say, you know, the skating still is a question, but it didn't look as problematic last night. And maybe that's because they were in such control that it was never, you know, really a challenge or whatever. But I thought he got around the ice fine last night, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you just didn't see, like, okay, maybe in some turns and skates where you have to watch him chase the puck, but Sweden didn't really have the puck to be able to dump it behind him and make him do the work there. And you know, maybe in some scenarios, if he gets caught in foot races or, you know, maybe his skating stride's a little awkward so he doesn't pick up as much pace. It is what it is, but at least at the level we're seeing him at, he's been dynamite. Over in Slovakia, he was absolutely dynamite on a very bad hockey team there. So playing in a pro league, absolutely crushed it. Coming over to the World Juniors, absolutely crushing it. All you can do is kind of play with the hand you're dealt, and even though there may be the question marks there, the results are impressive.
Yep, I liked his game, and I like him as a prospect. I also could not notice the hat trick from one Shane Wright, who will be, you know, one of the top couple picks in the 2022 draft. I think we can call him right now the likely number one overall pick in the 2022 NHL draft. He starts off his first, I think it's his first, what, official game, or how do you term this, since of the year?
Yeah, because, I mean, this is a guy who's been in the OHL, right? And the OHL never had a season. This is literally his first game of the year.
and he drops a hat trick, and the third goal of that hat trick was shorthanded.
Yeah,
he's Canada's captain.
Yeah, and he's, oh, by the way, a 2022 eligible. Yeah. It's like, this is insanity from him. I mean, maybe if you want to count the exhibition against Finland that they played on the 24th, I mean, that's really the only other game. He scored a goal in that game too, but, you know, coming out, I mean, his line was just absolutely dominant, you know, playing on a line with Dylan Genther. That was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously for a lot of Red Wings fans, that's the pipe dream. Do yourself a favor and do not bank on Shane Wright coming and saving the franchise. It's still going to be a lottery bounce to get him. And he's still very young, but it was very impressive last night. I want to know who else stood out to you in the games that you've watched so far. Did anybody on Sweden stand out to you in an 11-1 loss? And who else from the other tournament games you've watched so far popped?
So, I mean, I've watched both of Sweden's games, and honestly, almost the entirety of Team Sweden has looked like a dud. It looks like, honestly, a collection of talented players that are not playing a team system. There's a lot of individuality. You're not necessarily seeing, you know, some of those skill sets come out that you were hoping to see. You know, William Stromgren was a guy that I was hoping to see a little bit more of. I thought he looked better actually against Canada compared to his first game, but even still, the inconsistency and his tenacity after the puck is there. You know, you didn't really get to see anything from William Eklund, who's a guy that you want to see a lot from. You know, Simon Edvinson, I think, looked good in his first game. I think he shot the puck so much, almost Dougie Hamilton-esque with 6 shots on goal. Second game, though, absolute disaster. It's been really hard to evaluate Sweden because they're a team with just a lot of talented players that don't look all that good right now. And, I mean, they just got absolutely waxed by the Canadian team there. So I haven't been as impressed with them as I was hoping to be. But if we're going to talk about other guys who have been impressive, I think you have to go and look over at Belarus and Danila Klimovic, who, just like Shane Wright, had a nice hat trick, you know, in their game on yesterday. So I think he's been a really impressive player. You know, 6 foot, 190 pounds, right shot, centerman, playing over in Belarus. So has kind of flown under the radar a little bit for some people. But he's having himself a tournament with 4 goals in 2 games.
This is interesting. I mean, the Belarusian league, so he played, I don't know how to, he played 6 games in, I think, what I assume is the Belarusian pro league. What is the Vyshaya league? Do you know?
I don't know. I have not done, honestly,
I don't know anything about the Belarusian league other than it's where, yeah, Kirill Tuchiev played this year.
Yeah, I think the Vyshaya league is the second tier league in Belarus. Okay. So it would be like Allsvenskan in Sweden,
right,
or the VHL in Russia. So I think it's their second tier league, but yeah, I have not done enough homework on Belarus.
All right. Well, 6'1" right shot center. That's always a good place to start for prospects who has scored at the international level a little bit now here. I don't know that he's done it against like the top of the top competition yet. And so that'll make it something to watch, but I'm curious how much a guy like this can put himself on the radar, in a tournament like this. I mean, like, you go back, and obviously the DEL is a whole other level. You know, it is kind of just like one notch below, I think, the I guess you'd call them the big three over in Europe, the KHL, SHL, and Liga, and Moritz Seider played over there. But I do think, you know, when you go back and you do the retrospective on Moritz Seider, what a lot of people will say is one reason that they maybe were too low on him was, you know, who knew how to, like, you know, contextualize all that stuff. And then you saw a great performance at the World Junior B pool, or Division 1A pool, I guess it's called. And then you eventually saw it at the World Championships, and that was where it really solidified, or should have solidified, him as a top prospect. I'm not trying to pump these tires to the point that people are talking about him in the first round or anything like that, but just as a draft prospect, what can one tournament like this mean to a player's stock, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing, because with the limited ability to scout live this season, I strongly bet there's a lot of people who haven't seen Klimovic play in person.
I had never heard of him.
Yeah, and so that's the thing. You know, NHL Central Scouting will grade players, and those grades usually kind of estimate where they think a player will go. They had Klimovic as a C-rated prospect, which typically means 4th through 6th round coming into this tournament. I can pretty much guarantee he's not going to go in the fourth through sixth rounds at this point. He's a guy who's certainly working his way up the boards with these live views. I think, you know, continuing to see him play, continuing to see him compete, particularly against the higher competition, will be important. You know, I want to see if he can continue to play at this level against, if they get a shot at playing a team like Canada or they play a U.S. team. It would be a little bit more interesting to see how he makes his reads at those levels, how he positions himself defensively there. But ultimately, he's a guy with a lot of skill that has flown under the radar, and this tournament on the world stage is going to certainly offer him some opportunities to shoot up some draft boards.
It looks like he would be fifth in the league history for U19 players on a per-game basis, according to Elite Prospects, although I have not heard of any of the guys above him, which I think is noteworthy, although they are also very young. One guy did it last year. So I don't know what to make of his tournament. I don't know what to make of his production. I think that's what makes players like this a challenge at any time that you're digging into what they have done in a scouting context. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of it, but I think certainly he becomes a name that you start watching, and I think he'll be fun to follow wherever he does get drafted. And certainly I hope he goes off. I hope he has an unbelievable tournament and really puts himself on the map.
Yeah, I mean, I'm continuing to root for him to have himself a heck of a tournament here, because he's been a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I mean, you know, if you want to pop over to his teammate, Dmitry Kuzmin, who's a defenseman for Belarus, I think he also had a very nice game. I believe if you didn't catch the highlights, he scored a Michigan goal in that second game there. We're talking about a defenseman with the skill level to be able to pull that off is just ridiculous. So, you know, I think sticking there is a lot of fun. You pop over to Russia, and even though Russia has sort of been caved in their first two games, they somehow managed to take Finland all the way to the end of the game before blowing their 3-1 lead. They came back on the U.S. I think the score was at 1.51 U.S., and they came back to beat the U.S. 7-6. And honestly, that kind of comes down to their captain, Nikita Chibrikov, who's been, I think, quietly very good. He's another guy who's got a lot of skill. You wanted to see the competitiveness game in and game out. Well, he certainly answered the bell there. He's got, I believe, 4 points on the tournament, 2 goals, 2 assists. Very, very skilled player. You're looking at him maybe in the end of the first round, potentially. So with that Washington pick you're looking at. And then Sasha Pastrzyjov for the U.S. has also been one of their better scoring players, although admittedly he's been caught on the ice for a lot of the goals against. So something to watch on to make sure it's not just a one-way street with him. But those are a couple of guys that have just at least stood out thus far with pretty good performances.
Pastrzyjov, an option with the Washington pick.
Yep, Pastrzyjov and Chibrikov, I think, are two good options at that Washington pick there.
What'd you make of Edvinson in the Sweden game?
You know, I think the biggest issue with me with Edvinson was, like, he had all the tools, and you just needed to see the decision-making and making sure he wasn't getting himself caught on rushes and making sure that his in-zone coverage was, you know, up to speed. I thought his first game was not that great, but his game against Canada I actually didn't think was as bad, at least through the first two periods I watched. Obviously, statistically, it's going to look terrible for every player on Sweden, but at least him specifically, I thought he looked a little bit better. But he's just such a difficult player to evaluate because you like the tools, you like what he has. He's obviously got the prototypical size you would like in a defenseman, being 6'4", 6'5", and a good skater to boot. But you just got to make sure that all the pieces from the decision-making standpoint are there if you are going to be thinking about him in the top 10 of the draft.
I liked most of what I saw in the second two periods. There was a turnover at the offensive blue line I did not like, that I thought he should have just either went D to D or put deep, but tried to make a move and it became a turnover. But that happens, and that especially happens, like, if you're someone who wants more skill and more offense, sometimes those are things that players with offensive instincts and skill try to do, and you have to be willing to let them kind of make mistakes, especially the younger they are. You know, to put some of those things on tape, I guess, to know that they have them or can pull them off. That one didn't work. But, you know, I thought all told, I was not unimpressed by him. I think that the toolkit certainly pops.
Yeah, the toolkit is definitely there. The question marks are, you know, can you consistently do it? Can you make better decisions? Can you make better reads? Can you kind of rein in some of that desire to go chase the offense? And if so, then you have a player that can do everything.
All right. Shall we move on to the mailbag?
Let's hit it.
All right. We'll try to go through these relatively quickly today. What reason would there be to not have Lucas Raymond on the 2021-2022 opening night roster? That's from Brad.
This is a great question. You know, I think I've advocated maybe that I'm a little bit more in favor of having him on the 21-22 roster, just based on kind of what you and I talked about on the last episode, where I'd like to see some of these guys do their learning at the NHL level as opposed to kind of stepping down a tier and then potentially learning some bad habits. But I mean, reason to not have Raymond here is, one, if you don't think his injury is healed all the way, which we don't think that's a concern at all. But if you have any question marks about him being able to be successful at the NHL level, I think you don't. Number two, if you have any question marks about how well he transitions from the bigger ice to the smaller ice, which always gets brought up, although I don't know that anyone's definitively proved that it is tougher to make that transition. But I think if you have question marks in the organization about that and you'd like to see him in Grand Rapids first, I think that's reasonable. And then three, if the Wings go out and they have a ridiculous offseason and they bring in a lot of top six talent and you don't have minutes for him in the top six, I don't know that him grinding away 10 or 11 minutes on the fourth line is going to be what you want out of your top prospect. And you would likely rather him play bigger minutes at a lower level.
Yeah, I think my answer to this question is there's two reasons why he could not start. One is he's not ready and you think he needs more seasoning. And the other is you don't think that he's ready to play the kind of role that you're going to want him to play. I mean, you make room. You book him with a fourth overall pick. If he's ready, you make the space for him to play where he's ready to play. But if he's not ready to make you make that space, why on earth would you play him, 10, 11 minutes a night in the NHL when he could be getting 17, 18 minutes a night in the AHL? It's just nonsensical. So we've talked about who we kind of project in the picture for next year. Again, if you're looking at that, if the Red Wings do not trade a forward this offseason, which maybe they will, and this will be kind of moot, but you have kind of your top six wingers set. And so Lucas Raymond next year would probably need to be able to be better than one of Bertuzzi, Fabry, Zadina, Vrana next year to earn a spot in the top six. If he's not, I don't know why you push the pace with him. I mean, maybe you want to play him with, a guy like Namestnikov on the third line or a guy like Veleno on the third line. I guess you could do it. You'd probably still get enough minutes there to justify it. But again, you want to know, is he ready to do it? And is he ready to do it at a level to get enough minutes that you want to be playing? I don't think you want a situation here. He's already done that once in the SHL where he only played like 9, 10, 11 minutes a night his first year in the SHL. Obviously, he's shown he'll do it. But I think you want your young players who you've invested that much playing as much as they can. If they're not ready to do it in the NHL, why let them play less just to have them in your sweater?
Yeah, I agree. And now you could also say that all of those reasons are BS reasons, but they are reasons why people might use them. And who's to say? I think none of us really know where his game is going to look. I don't think anyone can conclusively say this game is going to look ready at the NHL right now. So yeah. It's just sort of which side of the coin do you fall on?
All right. Michael Fick asks, if you were to go back in time, would you still do the trade with Arizona involving Datsyuk, Netting, Hronek, and Cholo? Obviously, the other end of that trade is the pick that became Jacob Chychrun. I think we can safely say that if you undo the trade, you pick Chychrun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone's kind of taken a peek over at the stats for Chychrun on this season, but he has sort of avowed himself to potentially be in the top 10 for Norris consideration. I think he's been that good for Arizona this year. The statistic in particular, if you want to take a peek at it, is on Evolving Hockey's website. You look at their expected goals above replacement. I believe Chychrun is number one amongst defensemen in that metric, or number two. He's one of the top two players right there, but he's done it big minutes for Arizona. Even having two NHL defensemen in Philip Hronek and Dennis Cholowski, as good as that is, you would rather have the one elite NHL defenseman than two top four, top six defensemen.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, the thing about this trade is you never could have had the hindsight, right? Like that getting out of Datsyuk's contract was part of this. But if you're giving me the hindsight, of course, how can I not take the guy who, you know, I don't know if he'll be on my Norris ballot or not this year, but he's certainly someone I have to consider very strongly. And when you have a player that good, you know, it almost doesn't matter what the other side of the trade is. You know, like it you know, Hronek, I legitimately think is a legit top four defenseman on a contender. And yet I think Jakob Chychrun is a legit top pair defenseman on a contender. And, you know, as we've talked about on this podcast, there's a whole scale to that, that level is the hardest to find, hardest to achieve. If you're telling me that I undo that trade and I get Jakob Chychrun, how could I say no to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And Chychrun's just such a weird case where he was a guy who was the number two player heading into his draft season on most boards and somehow slipped all the way to 16. And so ended up being a nice steal for Arizona there. But hindsight, definitely go back and pick Chychrun.
Only thing that probably could have given you pause until this season was injuries, and he's stayed healthy, so.
Yeah, and he stays healthy, and he gives you Norris season, so.
Yep, that's right. All right, on to the next one. This one is from Sean. Outside of miraculous drafting, how do the Red Wings get out of the rut the Pistons were in for a decade? Not competing, but not bad enough to ever be in premium draft position enough times to turn it around.
I mean, and that was the whole crux of the articles that I wrote this past week was you have to go all in one direction, in my opinion, to get out of the rut. Because if you continue to kind of pin your hopes on one lottery ball that has a very low probability of being top three, particularly as the Wings make subtle improvements year after year, you're going to be stuck in mediocrity for a really long time. So you either need to push in on, let me go get elite talent in a different manner via the offer sheet or some other manner, or you got to push all in on getting more and more draft picks and almost adopt like a Oklahoma City type rebuild like they're doing in the NBA right now, where I think they own like 17 first round picks in the next 4 or 5 years, which is just something ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the key is, you know, part of the reason the Pistons stayed where they were for so long is they kept drafting a guy, and then two picks later, a superstar would get drafted. And that's probably the biggest thing is, you know, as best you can control, which is not fully, but as best you can control, nail your draft picks. And that's an unreasonably high bar. I realize it. It's not something of if every GM and if every amateur scouting director could assure that, we would have perfect drafting. And you really could assure your future by what the draft order was. That is not the case right now. But if let's say Lucas Raymond is, which I see as a real possibility at this point, let's say that Lucas Raymond at the fourth overall pick was the highest draft pick the Red Wings make in their rebuild. If that is the case, you have to just really work to maximize what you can at the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, whatever it's going to be, draft spot as best you can. I mean, you just have to do the best with what you're given. It's not like the Pistons didn't have a lot of top 10 picks, you know. Greg Monroe, Brandon Knight, Andre Drummond, KCP, Stanley Johnson, even Killian Hayes. I mean, all those guys are top 10 picks. How many of them turned into stars? That's the key, you know.
Yeah. You got to be able to draft with the picks that you get. And if you're not confident in your drafting, you got to get yourself some more ping pong balls.
Nezzy asks, in Prashant's full teardown option, why not trade Larkin?
Out of respect for Max.
Good answer.
That's really it. I mean, you should be open to it. You should be open to it. I'll just say that. And if he's going to net you the best return, then you go that route. But obviously, no, more seriously, there is a... there's a culture aspect to making sure that you're not completely wiping out anyone who can bring this team up. You're not wiping out anyone who was tethered to kind of that prior culture atmosphere that the Red Wings had built and cultivated for so many years. I think that's just as important with Dylan Larkin as his on-ice play. And if you wipe all of that out, sure, that's maybe the best strategy from a purely objective standpoint. But I do think that has some bad outcomes that are maybe a little bit hard to pick up on just the surface.
Do you think it's possible that there would be like a Ryan O'Reilly vibe there of like Buffalo trades him, he goes, he wins a cup, and you're like, uh-oh. That's because that's one reason. Like, I'm a risk-averse person. That's one fear I would have in that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that you have a player who could be unlocked by another team to really hit that Ryan O'Reilly type tier, then yeah, you have to absolutely be worried about that. And Buffalo completely botched that deal. And now look at Buffalo, where they're at. They're going to be in the worst. They're the worst team in the league once again. So, you know, you do have to be careful, but it's honestly not related to Ani's performance. You should trade him if you're doing this purely objectively. But I think there is a culture aspect that Dylan Larkin brings to this hockey team that, you know, you shouldn't sacrifice, you know, for the sake of adding one more ping pong ball.
And also out of respect to me.
And out of respect for Max.
Yeah. Cider and Juice says, Blasher seems to really like going 11-7. What are the advantages and drawbacks to that choice compared to 12-6? He says it feels difficult to develop line chemistry in that system, but can see how the opposition would have to deal with varied lines. You have some good stats on the Red Wings going 11-7, especially at LCA.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at this in the last month where Blashill has done this a handful of times, so these stats may be a little bit out of date, but I had looked at this through March 20th, and when Blashill had gone 11-7 at home, the Wings were actually 12-6-1, scoring almost 3 goals per game, giving up about 2.75, but at least a positive goal differential. But, you know, funnily enough, when Blashill had gone to 11-7, but did it on the road, again, you know, maybe there's the subtleties of that coach not having the last line change anymore. The Wings are 0-5-2 in Blashill's career, and they are absolutely cratered in those games. They score 1.86 goals per game, giving up 4.86 goals against. I don't know if there really is anything to this home-road split.
Well, last change could be relevant there.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. It's like, is last change enough to drive a difference of 3.5 goals against per game? I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's probably overstated. And these numbers, again, may have changed since March 20th, which was the last time I pulled them. But
also be interesting to see who the opponents are, like road and home, with a sample this small. Like if in 7 games, if those 7 were all against Tampa and Carolina, that would explain 80% of it. You know?
Yeah, that would be exactly it. So that's why I don't know if there's anything to the split besides things that I haven't documented. But yeah, I mean, I think line chemistry is somewhat overrated, and I think line matching is somewhat overrated. I think skilled players know where to be, and within the cracks of a system, those players should be there. And sure, you can say that there are certain guys who play very well together. I mean, we've talked about it over the course of the year, like Datsyuk and Zetterberg always knew where they were. The Sedin twins obviously always knew where they each other were. And so there's something in that regard. But I do think globally speaking, it is a little overstated. So I don't really have an issue with it. Particularly if you're trying to rotate in a couple of younger defensemen and get them kind of protected matchups.
I think what I've heard about this is the forwards, well, at least the conventional wisdom about this is the forwards don't mind it because they get more ice time, and the defensemen don't like it because nobody gets, you know, their normal ice time this way.
Right. it's a funny strategy. I would personally go the opposite direction and play more forwards and less defensemen, but, you know, we're in a league that is adamant about having no goals whatsoever, and we just saw a classic game of that between Tortorella and Blashill. And so that's why you see the 11-7 strategy come out.
This is from me, but two advantages I could see. Number one, allows you to get more specialists in the lineup when it comes to defensively. Like if you're the Red Wings and you wanted to get Christian Juice a game to run your power play, or Dennis Chalowski, although I think he has again looked better and at even strength as well. But if you wanted to get kind of a power play specialist into your lineup, it's one way to do it. And in terms of the forwards, if you don't have a forward crop that you're fully confident in 12 guys, it's a way to play the 11 you're confident in, and you can kind of keep rotating, almost giving your skill guys those extra minutes. And if you have a line that, you know, let's say your 2-man line is Michael Rasmussen and Bobby Ryan was one for a while. If you just rotate through and you can give Mantha some shifts on that line, Svechnikov some shifts on that line, Zadina some shifts on that line, Larkin some shifts on that line, all of a sudden you have 2 lines or 3 lines instead of 1 or 2 that you actually like the scoring potential of. Those would be the advantages that I could see to it.
Yeah, particularly if you want to rotate some skill forwards through with some of your other really high skill guys. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense.
So, and you know, I don't think the drawbacks that he suggested are unreasonable. I believe in chemistry, but I don't know if it's just because it was beaten into my head my whole life that it exists. I don't know.
I mean, it's just funny. Like, those are some of the just concepts that I think are always discussed and talked about. But again, to my knowledge, I don't know that anyone's necessarily proved that it exists. So I'm just going to be as skeptic as I always am.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, last one is a quick one from Cody. If each of you started for the Red Wings tomorrow, what number would you be wearing? And the reason I like it is because you have to, as Red Wings instead of NHL, is because you have to take into account the retired numbers.
That is true. And conveniently enough, I think the number I would wear just opened up because when I was a goalie in my younger days, I wore 39 for Dominic Hasek. And there now seems to be a void of a 39 on the Red Wings. So very clearly, I would be picking up 39 and going that way.
First hockey number I ever had was 12 because I had two cousins who wore 11 and 13. And before I actually played hockey, they had me like a jersey printed. That was me, and I was number 12 to go in between them. That one's taken. That's Sid Abel. Next number I had was number 17. That one's taken by Philip Hronek. In high school, I wore number 24. That one's taken by Richard Ponick and John Merrill before him. So I would have to go with the number I've been wearing in Beer League, which is 95.
All right. So we're going to throw it back to the Dmitry Mironov days. I love it.
I just think more guys should wear numbers in the 90s. You know what I mean? Like, it looks cool.
It looks way cooler. There's this whole, again, I don't know what the issue is, but more guys should be able to do this. And you know what? I would love to see it. Nemestikov looks really, really cool. Joe Valeno looked really cool out there.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. So yeah, give me more guys with numbers in the 90s. But for me, unfortunately, you know, my number 39, I'm going to have to stick with that.
All right, fair enough. That'll do it for us today. Red Wings are going to Carolina on Thursday, and then a pair of games at LCA against Tampa Bay on Saturday. And Sunday. We will be back here early next week to break all of that down for you. Until then, take care.